My guest on Takes on the World today, Alan Hart, is a former Middle East chief correspondent for Britain's Independent Television News and a former presenter on BBC's Panorama specializing in the Middle East. He's the author of several important books, beginning with the 1984 biography of Yasser Arafat entitled Terrorism or Freedom Fighters, Yasser Arafat and the PLO, and in 2009, the U.S. edition of a trilogy, a very important trilogy, Zionism, The Real Enemy of the Jews, which contains not only important details and firsthand history of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, but how that conflict has shaped the politics and policies of the United States and the Western world. Welcome, Alan Hart, to Takes on the World.
Jeff, it's great to be with you. I have fond memories of when we met in London many years ago.
And I believe I owe you a couple of gin and tonics.
That's right, you do.
Let's begin with a statement of yours on the current situation of the Palestinians that you wrote a few weeks ago, and which I mentioned during my earlier commentary before I got you on the air. The truth,
I heard that.
Yes, but your truth, you say, is the situation of the occupied and oppressed Palestinians is worse than it has ever been, and is worsening as Israel continues its defiance of international law and gobbles up more and more Palestinian land and water resources, end quote. That happens to be a sentiment with which, sadly, I have to concur, but I'd like you to elaborate on how you came to that conclusion.
What is really, I find, so concerning and saddens me so much, that there are a lot, as you know as well as I do, Jeff, there are many pro-Palestinian activist groups around the world, and they campaign. But what have they actually achieved? And the answer is in a very simple statement, which you've quoted. The situation of the occupied and oppressed Palestinians is worse than it's ever been. So we can actually say the campaigning, it has made a few more people aware of the injustice done to the Palestinians by Zionism and the need to right it. But this awareness is not on a big enough scale to develop political momentum to cause governments to use the leverage they have to call and hold the Zionist, not Jewish, state to account for its crimes. Now, why is this? My analysis is very simple, Jeff. The conflict in and over Palestine that became Israel is essentially an information war. And we have on the one side the Zionist masters of deception who have unlimited funds to tell and sell their lies. And on the other side we have the truth tellers, you're one, I'm another, there's Glenn Pappy, you know, we can name them all. There aren't many, very many.
And you're back. I'm sorry, Al, we lost you.
Yeah, okay.
You were speaking about all the forces arrayed against us, those who are trying to tell the truth about the Israel-Palestine conflict.
Yeah, I mean, you know as well as I do, Jeff, that the truth is absolutely overwhelming. And I strongly believe that if over the last 30 years or so, Americans had been informed of the truth of history, I think they would have been decent enough to insist that their government acted. So I really do think that if the war for truth had been properly resourced, Zionism could have been contained by now and possibly defeated.
But of course we have a media which at one time actually going back to the late 70s and 80s, looking at some of the media and criticism of Israeli policies, was quite extraordinary. But now it's like a solid wall of Israel propaganda coming from the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, etc. It's very difficult when even we have the alternative media, the internet, but people go on the internet largely to get what they want to read, more of what they ordinarily do. So the people who need to hear or read what they need to read aren't going online to get it, in a sense. Okay.
You were talking about the mainstream media, Jeff.
Right.
But, Jeff, there's a point I would like to make about the mainstream media. Basically, there is some truth in the story that very wealthy Jews do control important sections of the media. But I think the problem is worse than that. Throughout North America and Western Europe, I think the main media problem is self-censorship, fear of offending Zionism. I mean, if you look at it this way, newspapers don't exist to sell newspapers. They exist to sell advertising space. And what they fear is, if they offend Zionism too much, the advertising revenue plugs will be pulled. That's a large part of it, self-censorship, Jeff.
It's true, and actually they will get letters and phone calls from angry readers who are organized by Israeli lobby groups. And so for many of them, they just said, why take on this headache? Because when they say something positive or critical of Israel, they do not get the support from pro-Palestinian sources.
Well, Jeff, you're spot on, and I can illustrate that from the BBC. When the BBC makes a program that offends Zionism, which it occasionally does, it can get 10,000, repeat, 10,000 emails of protests and complaints and false charges of anti-Semitism. Now, as you know, they're only organized, these 10,000 emails, by a couple of groups. But if you're a busy editor, reporter, producer, you simply don't have the space for all this hassle.
I have talked to programmers years ago when I was getting publicity for progressive Israelis and Palestinians who come to the Bay Area, who said they did not want to go through the hassle that they had gone through when they had guests on the air who criticized Israel. And so, and one, Owen Spann, who is a top broadcaster, morning broadcaster in San Francisco, up until 1984, when I had him interview an Israeli refusenik, Yesh Gavul, who had opposed the war in Lebanon and told the truth about Lebanon, that cost Owen Spann his job, and he was replaced by a Zionist, a strong supporter of Israel, who's been in that seat ever since. So it's a message to people in the media to keep their nose clean and out of this issue. And of course, you had a really good career in the media. You decided to plunge into this issue, and you paid for it.
Well, I was born in 1942. And if you're my generation in Europe, you come out of your mother's womb almost programmed by the Zionist story. And then you're a very young reporter. You're going on your first assignment to the Middle East. You hardly know where Israel is, let's be honest. So how do you research? You go to your organization's news cuttings library to brief yourself. And you read the Times, and you read the Express and the Telegraph. So you set out conditioned. I didn't come to the truth of this conflict until very late in the day, when in 1980, I had parted company with the institutional media to do my own thing. And I began engaging with Arafat and his senior leadership colleagues. And you know, it was late in my career that I came to the truth of history. Unfortunately, I had a wife to whom I'd been married for 51 years who allowed me to do what I thought was right.
Well, you were actually with the Israeli troops when they crossed the Suez in 67. You met with Golda Meir. You met with most of the major leaders in Israel and the Middle East. In that period, you had a chance to really see it firsthand.
Well, one of the problems for Zionism with me, Jeff, is that its masters know that they can't credibly accuse me of anti-Semitism. Because, as I'm sure you know, the first picture, Volume 1 of the trilogy of Zionism, the real enemy of the Jews, is of Golda Meir, minister, and it is inscribed and a good friend, Alan Hart. Now, when I lecture and debate in America, if anybody accuses me of anti-Semitism from the audience, I hold up this picture, I read aloud her inscription, and I say to my accuser, do you think that old lady was so stupid that she couldn't have seen through me if I was anti-Jew? And that tends to bring the house down on my side. But you see, my strength, I believe, is that I can tell the truth about the Palestinians and Zionism without being a Jew basher. Because I am driven by two motivations, Jeff. I want to stop a final Zionist ethnic cleansing of Palestine, but I would also like to stop another great turning against the Jews, which I believe is inevitable if Israel continues on its present road.
I agree with you, and this is a sentiment that was expressed to me by Israelis when I first went into Israel who criticized their government's position and realized that the way that Israel was going was going to backfire one day. And my friend, one of the friends, Gideon Levy, who is who was a refuser, was a war hero at one point in Israel in the 73 war, but then became a resistor, said that we haven't learned the lessons of the Holocaust, and it's going to cost us.
Yeah, well, Gideon I always describe as the conscience of Israeli journalism. But, Jeff, what is worth noting historically, that prior to the Nazi Holocaust, most Jews of the world were utterly opposed to Zionism's colonial-like enterprise. They knew it was morally wrong, but most of all, what they feared was that if the big powers allowed Zionism to have its way, it would one day provoke anti-Semitism. So their fears are becoming... I mean, what are we seeing in the world today, Jeff? We're seeing a rising global tide of anti-Israelism, which is not anti-Semitism. The danger is that it could be transformed into anti-Semitism. And it was one of Israel's great directors of military intelligence, a man called Huckabee, who first warned of this way back in the 1980s. And I think that's... And here we have this paradox. We have this Zionist, not Jewish state that was created allegedly to be the refuge of last resort from Jews from everywhere when the world turns against them again. And yet it's this very state by its actions and policies that is provoking the anti-Semitism.
Exactly so. And in certain ways, there are individual in leadership positions in the Jewish community who profit from that, because anti-Semitism is kind of the glue that holds the community together, the organized community together, and the propaganda they put out, their first target actually is American in America, is American Jewry, to make them believe another Holocaust is around the corner. And yet without what Israel, if Israel was not doing what it was doing, there'd be no basis for concern.
No, I agree. And the man who does more to promote the world will always be against us than anybody else is, of course, Netanyahu. That's, you know, that's his theme. And that's the justification for what Zionism does. The world will always be against us.
My guest is Alan Hart, journalist. We're talking about, well, the title of his book, Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews. You can go back and find numerous Jewish writings in which Jews who were anti-Zionist predicted exactly the situation which you described, question of dual loyalty. We have, for example, an ambassador in the United States, Michael Oren, who one day was an American citizen, and the next day he's an Israeli who becomes the ambassador from Israel to the United States. People might wonder, when did he change his loyalties?
Yeah, it's a real problem, the dual loyalty, isn't it? I mean, one of your presidents, I've forgotten which one it was, it might have been Roosevelt, who dared to raise that very issue one day, didn't he, about dual loyalty. But he got slapped down so much, he stopped using the phrase. But it seems to me that the only way that the Jews of North America and Western Europe can avoid complicity in Zionism's crimes is by distancing themselves from the Zionist monster. Is there any sign, Jeff? I see little signs, but is there any real sign that American Jews are being
I don't see. I don't see really any signs. There's some indifference, and the lobby is made of what they call the lobby. It's more like a hotel with 1,000 rooms, many of which we can't get into. There's a core, maybe a quarter or a third, and the rest are mostly indifferent, but are afraid to speak out because of fear themselves, because the lobby will target Jews who criticize Israel. But I want to switch actually gears to the larger problem of what's happened to America. But so you go into that in your book. We have, most people are not aware of the role that President Kennedy, the last president really, there was George Bush the first, but Kennedy had certain positions which the Israelis did not like, and he was really adamant, the last president to really try to stop Israel from getting nuclear weapons. And I want you to trace the path that American presidents have taken down to their knees or on kissing the boots of the Israeli prime minister, from Kennedy to Johnson and on to President Obama, if you would.
Yeah, well, Jeff, this is very interesting. When I began my research on my three-volume epic, which incidentally is about much more than its title suggests, it's a complete rewrite of the whole history of the conflict, exposing Zionism's lies and replacing them with the documented truth of history. And it's updated to Obama's surrender to the Zionist lobby. But I wonder how many of your readers know the detail of what you've just said. President Eisenhower.
Probably very, very few, because they don't learn it in the school book, in the schools. And actually, people, unfortunately, there are many people who support the Palestinian cause don't talk about that period.
Well, the point is that Eisenhower was the first and the last American president to contain Zionism. We'll come to Kennedy in a minute. You remember when Israel colluded with Britain and France to invade Egypt in 1956? Well, Eisenhower had huge problems with the lobby because he wanted to punish Israel. But most of all, he wanted Israel to get the hell out of the occupied Egyptian territory without condition. But anyway, what he basically says is that if Israel is allowed to attach conditions, it will destroy the UN and it will destroy international law. And he read the Riot Act to them. Now, along comes Kennedy. Now, in my view, if Kennedy had lived and had a second term, he would have continued the Eisenhower policy of containing Israel. And more than that, he was working early in his second term of bringing together in Washington Egypt's President Nasser and the new Prime Minister of Israel, Levi Eshkol, because Kennedy had used his influence with Golda Meir to get rid of Ben-Gurion because of the confrontation over the failure to let the Americans inspect Dimona, you know, the nuclear plant. Now, Eshkol had gone on the record with a policy statement saying that Israel didn't need more land beyond the 1948-49 armistice borders. So Kennedy realized that in this new Israeli prime minister, he perhaps had a good chance of peace. And there's something else that people ought to know about John F. Kennedy. Although he had to take American funds, Jewish funds for election purposes, he made 7 or 9 attempts in his first term to clean up the corruption of lobby money in politics, and he was defeated each time he tried. But I'm quite sure that if Kennedy had had a second term, there would not have been a switch of American policy to support for Israel, right or wrong, and there might well have been peace in his second term. That's how important John F. Kennedy is, and that was a revelation to me when I came to write my book, because I started it, I thought I had pretty much everything. Okay, and then we come to Johnson. And Johnson, of course, was pretty much a gut Zionist. And that's partly because he did one of the Nazi death camps and left a big stain on it. But he just realized you had to play the game the Zionist lobby's way if you wanted to be a president and not have too much hassle. Thereafter, various presidents had a little bit to take on Zionism. I mean, President Carter tried a little bit, but really, basically, it is the Zionist lobby that calls the shots on American foreign policy for the Middle East.
And increasingly so, even in Britain, you have the Labour Friends of Israel, the Conservative Friends of Israel, the Liberal Friends of Israel. Britain is not as important as the United States. The United States is absolutely critical. It's Israel's most important strategic asset, one would say, most important occupied territory, much more important than the West Bank. But by influencing, having lobbies in the United States and in the major Western countries, it makes it very difficult to mobilize any international opposition to what Israel's doing, even if politicians privately will admit that they're bewildered and frightened of the potential of what Israel could do.
Closed doors, most of the leaders and governments of Western Europe are sick and tired of Israel.
But they can't say it. As a matter of fact, Obama did, in exchange with Sarkozy, say that Netanyahu was a headache. And rather than not trying to understand why Netanyahu was a headache for President Obama, President Obama gets criticized for mentioning that Netanyahu was a headache. I mean, when the Netanyahu came here in 3 days after insulting President Obama publicly, he was given 29 standing ovations by the Joint House of Sessions of Congress, there should have been outrage in the United States. But there wasn't even outrage on the part of the organizations that claim to support the Palestinians.
Well, that's right. But you see, my take on Obama, I was one of those, no doubt you might have been one, who invested some hope in him when he came into office.
No, I wasn't one.
I don't believe, Jeff, that he came into office, like many do believe, as a Zionist stooge. What I think the truth is, he was very young, he was very inexperienced, and I think it's not until your bum hits the seat of the Oval Office chair that you realize how powerful the lobby is.
Well, actually, although he was very close to some financial supporters of the Chicago Jewish community, just after he came into office, he received two letters, one from the House, three-quarters of the members of the House, and three-quarters of the members of the Senate, Republicans and Democrats, telling him before he met with Netanyahu that when he met with Netanyahu, he should put no pressure on Netanyahu, and in effect telling this popular new president what he couldn't do in relations to Israel, as if suddenly he's the president of the United States, but his Congress, including the Democrats, were pro-Israel more than they're more pro the United States, clearly. You have the Steny Hoyer, the House Minority Whip, calling a press conference and speaking at a press conference in Jerusalem. You have Steny Hoyer speaking at a press conference in Jerusalem, taking the position of the Prime Minister of Israel against the President of the United States. And actually, when Clinton was the president, Dick Gebhardt, this liberal Democrat, did the very same thing when Netanyahu was Prime Minister then as well, actually taking a policy position against that the President of the United States in support of a foreign government. It should be an impeachment situation. But when it comes to Israel, anything goes, right?
Jeff, can I,
yes.
Alan, back again. Can I add a thought about American presidents and their problems?
Yes, yes.
I once had the pleasure of having a very private conversation with Jimmy Carter when he was out of office. And the message I got was, bring your wife, because Rosalind and I work as a team, so my wife came with me. And he made to me two statements. The first was that any American president has only two windows of opportunity to take on the Zionist lobby. In the first 9 months of his first term and the last year of his second term, if he has one. But he made one other statement. Do you remember, Jeff, way back in 1977, Carter worked with the Russians, the Soviet Union, on that joint U.S.-Soviet declaration for peace? Do you remember that?
Yes, and it was one of the reasons that he got a minority of the Jewish vote in 1980 against Reagan.
The point is this. The whole world of commentators really did believe for a minute that this could be the solution, you know, the Russian-U.S. agreement. Now, the Arabs accepted it without reservation. The PLO accepted it without reservation, even though it gave them nothing. The only people who rejected it was Israel. But how did they reject it? Dayan had crossed the floor and become the foreign minister in Israel's government.
Moshe Dayan, yes.
He went to the White House, and he spent some time with Carter. And when he walked out, Carter had torn up the joint U.S.-Soviet declaration and replaced it with a new memorandum of understanding between Israel and America. Now, when I talked with Carter, I said to Mr. President, most people think that you surrendered here simply because you got the usual message, if you continue down this line, you won't be reelected for a second term. And I said, Mr. President, I don't believe that. If you had pulled off peace, they might have offered you a third term. And then he told me what the other big fear of American presidents is. And in his conversation with Dayan indicated it. Dayan said to Carter, words to the effect of, Mr. President, you must know that my prime minister is mad. He could bomb the oil fields. So it's not only, Jeff, the power of the Zionist lobby. American presidents are seriously frightened of the mayhem that Israel might create in the region if it was pushed too far.
I agree with you on that. I remember even a brief conversation with Ehud Olmert during the Lebanon War when I and my sister bravely had confronted him when he came to quote-unquote debate on the Lebanon War in 83 and in 82 in San Francisco, and he admitted that Israelis had missiles, nuclear missiles, trained on Moscow. And then he said, but that doesn't mean we're going to use them. And then he repeated it, just to make sure we heard that. And I'm sure they might have missiles trained elsewhere as well. And it's quite logical to believe that Israel could do such damage to the world economy. Even an attack on Iran would set the global economy, which is shaky at the moment, off the edge.
Let me give you a little anecdote from my book.
Yes.
I knew Moshe Dayan very well and had private conversations with him. And as I quote in full in the book, I said to him, I think it was in 1969, I said, why really have you got nuclear weapons? I said, we both know you don't need them vis-a-vis the Arabs. You can beat the Arabs any day of the week with both hands tied behind your backs with conventional weapons. And he said, in effect, that the reason why Arabs, they had nuclear weapons, was because he, Dayan, Ben-Gurion, and others had realized from the very start that a day would come when even their best friends, he meant America, would say, enough is enough, Israel. And at that point, Israel would say to the president, don't push us too far, mister, or else. They have nuclear weapons as the ultimate blackmail power.
That Seymour Hersh kind of pointed that out in his book, The Samson Option. But it isn't just really government position. I have met Israelis or people who emigrated to Israel who said, we go, the whole world goes with us.
Well, Jeff, very early in my book, I quote from a Panorama interview I did with Golda Meir, and it's very dramatic. It was transmitted at 8 o'clock in the evening on a Monday. And at a point in the conversation, I say to her, Prime Minister, I just want to be clear that I understand what you've just said. You have just said that in a doomsday situation, Israel would be prepared to take the region and the world down with it. And Jeff, without a pause, she said, yes, that's exactly what I mean. But that wasn't the end of the story. It was transmitted at 8 o'clock in the evening. By 9 o'clock, the Times of London, then a seriously good newspaper, not the Murdoch rag it is today, it had changed its lead editorial to quote what Golda had said to me and then added its own opinion. We had better believe her.
You had better believe her. It's a sad commentary on when thinking how many years after World War II and the Jewish Holocaust that the next Holocaust could come from Israel.
Yeah.
A far greater one.
But in a sense, the context here, if we've time, to move swiftly to what Israel is doing in Syria. You indicated
yes.
to me that you might like a thought on
yes,
that.
Yes.
My thought is this, that Israel's attacks are driven primarily by political motivation, not military motivation. Israel was sending a message to the region, the whole Arab world and Iran, saying, when the red lines we set are crossed, we act. What I think the Israelis were actually doing is what their leaders do from time to time, to reinforce the deterrent power of their superior military might. But it also could be, and this is interesting, it could be that they were putting pressure on Obama. Because, look, he's been made to look rather foolish. He talked about red lines last year, and he's done nothing about it. So the most recent attacks that Israel launched on Syria may be their way of giving the Zionist lobby ammunition to really turn the heat on Obama to do something. And yet there may be another Israeli consideration at work. They are aware that most Americans do not want their country to become engaged in another useless, expensive Middle East adventure. And with Obama at the White House, they fear that if they trigger something catastrophic, they could be on their own. It might not necessarily follow that America comes to their aid. So this could all be part of their background thinking that is getting them to give the Zionist lobby information to press Obama. What about that, Jeff?
I think the Zionist lobby has, from the beginning, been pressuring Obama to act. And We just have Elliot Abrams, the criminal from Iran-Contra, has been writing a series of columns for the Council of Foreign Relations, talking about Obama being spineless. And there is this pressure. And actually tomorrow, as I mentioned earlier, but it won't be in the media here, the Washington Institute for Near East Policy, APAC's think tank, is hosting two military officials from the Syrian Free Syrian Army in an event that will not be reported in the U.S. media. One thing that I mentioned earlier before I called you was the possibility that isn't being counted on, that Syria, which has military that doesn't begin to compare with Israel, might respond at this point to an Israeli attack simply because it has nothing to lose.
And I don't think, Jeff, there's any chance of that. I mean, I haven't written recently much about Syria, but the point that I think not enough people know is in the 30 years or so of the rule of this Assad's father, Syria, frankly, was more an Israeli ally.
But we have actually come down to the end of the show. I want to tell you all that his books are called Zionism, the Real Enemy of the Jews. It does not begin, the title doesn't cover the story. This is his history of the rise of Zionism in Israel, the political machinations that went on with the British and with the United States, and I strongly recommend it to you. And I don't know if Alan can hear me, but I appreciate him having taken the time to be on the air today with us. Real treasure. AlanHart.net is his website.